Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford and Leo Laporte, episode number 29 for Friday, January 1st, 2010. Tick tock, tick tock. What's up with the atomic clock?
Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by the new voice-activated sync, featuring hands-free calling, music and podcast search, and turn-by-turn navigation, available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRide.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode number 29, for Friday, January 1st, 2010. We're in the
Happy New Year, everyone.
And in honor of the new year,
Kiki brought champagne.
I did. I brought champagne, of course. The New Year's beverage of choice. I have no idea what carbonated wine has to do with the new year.
Well, it's festive and bubbly and sparkly.
I mean, bubbles are festive.
Yeah.
You know, like shiny things, like glitter. Yeah. But also, in honor of the new year, we are talking about time. I thought it would be a very timely topic, and that's very punny, I know. Our topic, though, is the atomic clock. And we we're joined today by Andrew Novick from NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. But first, a word from Sync.
So I thought it'd be kind of fun to do a Ford Sync commercial from the car. So here we are in the Mustang. Now, the first thing that happened already is my phone is connected, which is kind of funny because my phone is back in the studio, but it sees that via Bluetooth. And so now it's playing my my book, which is Jerry Pournelle's Mote in God's Eye. But that's one thing that's cool. It does A2DP, so it can actually play stereo audio from the phone. And if I go to a media, you'll see that it's coming from my 3G phone, and I can pause it and so forth. More interesting, though, is using the USB connection. And all Sync vehicles have this. There's a USB port. So I have, I don't know if you can see it, but I have an iPod, and I plug it into the iPod's connector into here. And then I switch over to the source to USB. And I can press the sync button. Let me show you on the steering wheel here. This is the sync button here. So let me press the sync button. Audio. These are the choices. Sync.
USB.
Play artist U2. So then it heard that it was U2, and now it's going to play something by U2. I can do this too, though, some other things. So I could play any song. Travel link. This is the serious travel link stuff. This is amazing. 5-day weather forecast. But it's not just weather. I got fuel prices. I've got movie listings. Here's the nearest gas station. Here's the Chevron. It'll navigate me to there. Again, you don't have to have the screen. The beauty of Sync is you can have the GPS without a GPS, expensive GPS screen. Destination. Home. And now it'll guide me home through the GPS. Now, with the Sync, again, if you don't have the screen, it'll just tell you the instructions. So you're really never even looking down at this. The whole time you're looking out, driving. You're never get your hands off the wheel. You never take your eyes off the road. It's really amazing. Sync also has some other great features like 911 assist. It'll use my phone and call 911 if the airbags are deployed. Let's hope I never need to use that. It also gives me vehicle history reports and a whole lot more. This is an amazing technology. And it's all comes down to this one sync button on your steering wheel and the ability to command the computer in the car to do almost anything. I just love it. Audio. Sync. See, I have other sources here, too. So.
USB.
Play track Daily Gizwiz.
D-A-I-L-Y.
You get the idea. So there you go. Thanks for taking a little tour of my car. I think you're going to enjoy the Ford Sync. Make sure you test drive it at your local Ford or Lincoln or Mercury dealer, and come see us at CES. We're going to be showing off the Sync in the Lincoln and having a lot of fun. We'll see you next time. Thanks to Sync for taking us to CES. Bye-bye.
We're joined today by Andrew Novick from NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and he's an engineer. Hello, Andrew.
Hi.
Hi. And you're an engineer at NIST, and you work on algorithms pertaining to the atomic clock. And the other day, you specifically told me, broke it down, that you build measurement systems to compare atomic clocks remotely, and you used GPS, global positioning satellites, real-time measurements, and data exchange
Wow.
to get accuracy to the nanoscale. Now, nanoscale is like 10 to the minus 15, right?
It's nanoseconds.
Nanoseconds, sorry.
Yeah, I wrote it. It's a billionth of a second.
Billionth
ten
of a second.
To the minus nine.
To the ninth, sorry. See if I can get my scientific.
I got a couple of dumb. Can I start with dumb questions?
That's where we want to start.
I'm the guy who does dumb questions, Andrew, just so you know. First of all, isn't the idea of time kind of in general, I mean, made up? I mean, what is a second? What is a minute? What is an hour? It's tied to the revolution of the Earth around the sun and the rotation of the Earth.
It really is a human-made it's a human-made definition. So, in other words, if you wanted to have some your own duration and call it something else, you could do that, and it would be, you know, you could make it some arbitrary thing, and if you could get everyone to agree with it, then you would have your own time unit.
But worse than that, I mean, how accurate is the rotation of the sun of the Earth, or the revolution of the Earth around the sun and the rotation of the Earth per day?
That's a really good question. That's a loaded question. We could talk about that for a long time.
I'm sure it's less than a billionth of a second.
Well, it varies actually throughout the year, and it changes over the course of years. But that's why we have leap seconds,
right?
So, do you want to just jump into leap seconds?
Why not?
Let's just jump right in.
Time first.
Well, we know why we have leap years, because the calendar, we attempt to duplicate the
rotation
the year,
of
the revolution of the Earth around the sun.
Orbit.
But it's not exactly 365 days. It's 365 and...
like a quarter.
A quarter. Mm-hmm. So we have to add a day every 4 years. And even then, we have to add another day every 100 years, because that's not even quite right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really a kludge. It's a horrible kludge.
Do you agree?
It would be hard without a long time of kind of retrospect to figure out like what would be the ideal calendar. Because if it doesn't really break down... you know, with a certain number of days, it would be hard.
Right.
So when people from, you know, hundreds of years ago were trying to make up a calendar, they had to keep slightly adjusting it so it would work. You know.
Yeah. But you don't have to, you only have to worry about the daily rotation, right? That's, time is tied to the daily rotation of the Earth, right?
Well, not really. I mean, it is, the time of day is, that's where the leap seconds come in. So time was defined as breaking down the day into a certain number of defined units, which would be like hours, minutes, seconds. But when atomic clocks started to be used in the 60s, it turns out that the atomic clocks are much more stable than the rotation of the Earth. So we used to adjust the definition of the second to match the rotation of the Earth to try to get closer and closer. But because it varies all the time, they said, you know, to heck with that, let's leave the definition based on the cesium second, and we'll just every now and again we'll actually add or subtract a second to keep the official coordinated universal time in step with you know, where the Earth is in its rotation.
So somewhere,
so every so often we have to have a leap second.
Somewhere in the world there is a golden meter, and I presume there's a golden foot somewhere in the world. Maybe at NIST. Maybe you guys have the... I think it's in France, isn't it? The meter?
Right. Which could be a problem because of radioactive decay. It's
they have to... Yeah. They've got all sorts of problems. And they also have accretion of stuff.
Right,
so they have to kind of...
fudge the meter, fudge the foot. Right?
Is the canonical second the measurement of how much cesium decays in a second? Is that what it is?
It's not really decay. It's... it's a natural occurring frequency. It's the resonance
frequency
of cesium. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so frequency is 1 over time. And so if you can have a very defined frequency, then if you divide that down by the frequency, you
Got
have
it.
Time. So the resonant frequency of cesium, if you can make your own atomic clock and make a cesium transition change by hitting it with a certain frequency, then that would be the same frequency anywhere in the world.
Right.
So you would therefore, that's why atomic clocks are so great, because you have this naturally occurring frequency that you can get time from.
It's actually better than a golden meter, because it's not, or a kilogram, you know, because the gravitational field varies, but the time is always the same, at least on this planet.
Yeah, there is an issue, though. So you mentioned the issue of variability in the Earth's orbit, and so variability in the way time, the amount of time in a year. There's also a certain amount of variability in wouldn't there be a certain amount of variability in how these cesium atoms are affected by quantum fluctuations by gamma rays
a good question.
I mean, what's going to come in and what could, is there variation in fluctuation in this supposedly very accurate time-telling device?
And this is what Andrew has to worry about. He's got to be accurate.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually, you know, it's really interesting. The definition of the second comes from several different countries' realizations of their own definition of the second. In other words, we have like our best atomic clock, the NIST F1 fountain clock, cesium fountain. And so we're making measurements and getting what we're defining as a cesium second. And we actually make comparisons with countries all around the world who also do the same thing. And the Bureau of International Measurements in France, the BIPM, takes all of the data, and they actually publish the right answer after the fact as to how close everyone was. So, it's actually an agreed upon kind of average.
It's an average. Wow, that's really interesting. Figures the French would be somehow involved in this. They seem to really, they have it all tied up.
And you mentioned the meter. I just wanted to correct you. The definition of the meter now is not a it's not a physical standard meter. You know, it used to be a platinum iridium rod in Paris, and we would have one in America, and there's, you know, it varies. But actually, the definition of the meter change is actually based on a wavelength of light.
Better.
And one of the reasons is because frequency and time is actually the SI units. The second is the SI unit with the most resolution, the least uncertainty. So actually, several of the other SI units are based on the second for that reason.
You start with the second, and everything is derived from that?
From there forward.
Right. So something like the candela, you know, is a measurement of light. And so that's obviously comes from wavelengths. And so, therefore, frequency ties in. And so...
meter is the distance traveled by light in free space in 1,299,792,468 of a second, basically.
Basically.
In other words, how long, because the speed of light is roughly 300,000 meters per second. So it's that. It's how long light takes to travel a meter.
It's all relative.
Oh, man.
You guys mentioned relativity before, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Does relativity affect you, too?
It does, but it's in a very, thanks to Einstein, it happens in a very calculatable way. So... you know, we can calculate that out of our data, in the GPS.
Right.
It's very well defined.
It was really a great episode that Ray did in which he talked about how GPS has to make this adjustment for relativity, which is just fascinating.
For the different speed, and the relativity that we're talking about is the different speed at which, I guess the different speed at which time moves on different
I wasn't paying attention that
places.
Day in school.
So,
I think
so
it has
whether
to do,
you're on the surface of the planet
it's
or
the
whether
gravitational
you're,
force, that's
whether
right.
you're you know, miles, 50 miles above the planet, the gravitational force is going to act on you differently and thus affect the rate at which time passes.
Right. And relatively. It's also, I mean, the satellites are moving.
Right.
So it's the classic train whistle.
Right. The Doppler effect, right?
Yeah, the Doppler effect. If a frequency is coming towards you, it actually appears to you as a different frequency as if it's going away from you.
You know, it's
so if
amazing.
The satellite's moving, you have to take that into account.
It's amazing that this is so well understood and can be calculated. That's what's amazing to me.
It
proves Einstein, too, in a way, you know, right?
Yeah. Andrew, do you have any insight into, you know, this, this search for ever greater accuracy. I was looking through some of the pages on the NIST website, and there's a historical walkthrough of how humans have measured time throughout history. And we started out, you know, just watching the way shadows moved on the ground, then measuring it based on drops of water per given amount of time. We kept realizing throughout history that these measurement methods were not accurate enough for our needs. I mean, what drives us to go, you know, from the length of time of a water drop to nanoseconds to probably becoming even more accurate as we move forward in the future?
Yeah, I think that probably back then it was driven by necessity. In other words, they said, okay, if we can break down the day into smaller and smaller pieces, you know, we can start to make measurements of time intervals and things like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas nowadays, we're somewhat ahead of the curve in that sense, where we basically try to come up with better accuracy or, you know, lower uncertainties for these measurements. And then we let kind of science and industry figure out how to utilize that. So we're somewhat ahead, but we know that, you know, if we can do it, then it will improve things, you know, to come.
Do you think that having an atomic wristwatch,
which I do, I have a watch.
Yeah,
it's as many people do, but a lot of geeks do that. Every 24 hours synchronizes to the atomic clock at NIST.
Yeah, can you explain?
Actually, it's in Colorado Springs, right? Is it NIST or is it?
It's NIST. It's in Fort Collins.
Fort Collins, Colorado. That's where it is. Yeah,
near Fort Collins,
where WWV was is. Yeah.
Right.
And this is nothing like the algorithms that you put together. But can you explain how the coordination of all these atomic time systems work? I mean, lots of people have bought atomic clocks for their bedstands or their wrists, or.
Well, and I have to say, I'm sure that this isn't that accurate. Certainly not a nanosecond.
No, we. So we don't call those atomic clocks, because to us, atomic clocks are cesium-based.
There's no cesium here, yes.
Or some other atom like rubidium or hydrogen. Mm-hmm. So we call those radio-controlled clocks. And so what you have on your wall there and on your wrist, it's basically a quartz watch that, just like, you know, any kind of quartz watch that you would buy, like a digital watch. But it has a radio receiver in it, so that it can actually receive our 60 kilohertz broadcast. And it chooses to do it usually once or twice or three times a day.
Right.
Most likely in the middle of the night, because that's when the signal propagation is better.
Yeah, 1 a.m., I think. Yeah, or 11 a.m., so 11 p.m., something like that. Yep.
And so it synchronizes maybe once, and then it runs just as a normal quartz oscillator the rest of the day. And so then over the course of a day, your watch probably has not gotten off by more than a second.
Right.
So when it synchronizes every day, it will basically be, you know, always within the second.
It's close enough. It's within a second. I'll take that.
Yeah.
But for tonight, for the purposes of, we're recording this New Year's Eve.
Yes.
I will have the most accurate clock.
In the room.
In the room, I presume.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going by this, baby. You know, I have this, and a lot of radio people like me have it, is because we have to be synchronized with the studio, with our stations. I can't. I mean, I could be off by half a second, but I can't be off more than a second.
More than a second, no.
So I need these atomic clocks, actually. Now, most of our computers do the same thing, don't they, Andrew? They sync up to the clock.
Right. We have several different ways where your computer, you can find out the time on your computer. And so we have what's called the Internet Time Service, and it uses NTP, Network Time Protocol.
That's right, yeah.
So your computer will actually go to one of our servers and get a timestamp and set your computer clock. And we get a couple billion hits a day.
Wait a minute, say that again.
Billion.
What kind of servers are you guys running? That's amazing.
I know.
Well, you know, the NTP protocol is a very tiny packet of data. So, you know, if you were to download, say, this video on the internet, that's trillions of packets of data,
right.
Probably.
No, that's true. We do a trillion an hour. Yeah, yeah.
A server can, you know, can handle hundreds and hundreds of requests per second.
Okay. And it's a protocol that can be distributed. I noticed that my Mac, for instance, goes to ntp.apple.com.
Right.
Right. And so there's kind of a tiered system where a server, almost any server that you deal with on the internet is synchronized, you know, to another NTP server. And so, you know, they're all kind of synchronized together.
Right.
There are a bunch
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Andrew.
I was going to say that, you know, so what we're talking about two totally different things. I should feel like I should distinguish. And we have atomic clocks, you know, nanoseconds or sub nanoseconds. And then we're talking about time of day. And those, even though that we deal with both of those, you know, in our division, they're so much different things. Because time of day, you know, we're talking about, you know, you said it's good enough if you're within a second. Or like with NTP or, you know, some way of syncing your computer clock, maybe it's within, you know, several tens of milliseconds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the question comes up, why do I need to know nanoseconds?
Yeah. Who needs this accuracy and why?
Yeah, and so it's not time of day. Like time of day, we have that solved. You know, there's no problem. We can synchronize time of day. We can, you know, you can have stopwatches that measure, you know, Olympic events to hundredths or thousandths of a second. But for atomic clocks, you know, we talked about GPS. The whole GPS constellation, how it works is basically it's based on atomic clocks on board the satellites. And so because you have these really accurate frequency sources on the satellites is how you can get such accurate positioning.
Yeah, you actually have some interesting images that you sent me, and I forwarded those to Leo.
Oh, okay. So that means I have to go to work.
If you can check your email
those.
So that we can get those, get some images up. There are some really neat images that illustrate what you're talking about. I think from here we can probably go into talking about a little bit of, you know, how you measure, how you compare the two different atomic clocks.
Like the cesium fountain, that one?
There was a cesium fountain.
Yeah. Tell me what you want, and I'll show you what you want.
If you check your email for images,
you send me another
link. Forward, yes.
Oh, another link. Okay.
Yes.
Yes. All right.
Many links.
Looking,
it went into
searching,
his junk box.
Searching. No. Everything Kiki sends me. Here it is. Images for DKSH. I see them. Oh, that's cool. All right. Let me open these up. Save these.
Yeah, Andrew, can you tell us a little bit more about comparing using the... So you used GPS, the Global Positioning Satellites, to help compare different clocks on different places in the world. Can you tell us a bit about how you put that together?
Yeah. So we have a GPS receivers that can receive signals from... you know, depending on the receiver, say 8 satellites at a time. Mm-hmm. And so if you can see that many satellites, you can do really good positioning. But what we do is since we have a stationary position with our antennas just on the roof, so we're not trying to do positioning. So we're actually just getting timing data from all of those satellites. So we actually get a pulse from each satellite every second.
Okay.
And so we compare our local clock to every satellite that we can see every second, and we record the difference. So now there's some kind of a delay between from when the satellite broadcasts it to us. But because the satellite broadcasts its position and we know our position, then we can calculate out that delay. And so we basically have, you know, these comparisons, several pieces of data every second. And so say if you had a GPS receiver where you are and you were measuring the same satellites at the exact same time, mm-hmm. compared to whatever your best clock is, then we could exchange data. So I said, you know, from satellite 29, I was 4 nanoseconds off, you know, 10 seconds ago from that satellite.
Right.
And so you could say, well, I was 3 nanoseconds off from that satellite at that second. And so we could say, although there needs to be a lot of averaging, but we could say just, so that's a good graphic there.
Here we go. Yeah. This is so that we have a GPS satellite S. We have two clocks. You're triangulating almost.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, you have a clock in Colorado Springs, and you have a clock in France, it looks like.
It's called common view. So common view means we're both looking at the same thing at the same time and comparing it to our local standard. Think of it this way. Here's a good analogy. So say you have a clock, like a bell tower in the center of town, and I say, okay, when you hear the bell ring, look at your watch and tell and write down what time it is. So you hear the bell ring and you say, okay, it's, you know, it's the lunchtime bell or whatever. So you write down it's 12:01 and 15 seconds. And I write down what time I measured on my clock when the bell rang, and it was 12:01 and 10 seconds.
Right.
So regardless of what, if the bell is right or wrong or how far off the bell is, we know that between me and you, we're 5 seconds different from each other. So that's called a common view measurement.
So that's really purely relative. We don't know what the real time is. We just merely know our difference.
Our difference.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so when everyone around the world says, okay, this is what time we think it is, then, and we make all these comparisons and then do a big averaging algorithm, and it's really a weighted average. So the ones that are closest to the average get more weight, so it stays more stable. And so that's actually how we know, you know, what time it is, and the definition of frequency is based on these kinds of common view measurements.
Hmm. But that's not helpful in, like, what time it really is. Or is there, does it even make sense to say what time it really is?
I think it does. So we generate at NIST, we generate what we call UTC NIST. And so UTC stands for Coordinated Universal Time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if you call, say you call our phone number or you listen to WWV, and it says, you know, at the tone, the time will be 14:25, coordinated universal time. You hear the tick. Yeah, and that's been going on for 80 years.
Yeah. Used to call popcorn.
Yeah, we don't call popcorn anymore, that's for sure. No, I always called WWV. I was a WWV guy.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Popcorn was not that accurate, probably, huh?
No, that has been a problem where people will say, you know, I have my local phone number, the time and temperature, and it's 5 seconds off from what you guys say. You know,
right.
Who is right?
Right.
We only have, you know, we have our phone
number. The sound you're about to hear is not the real time. It's a sample of the sounds you would hear if you called the NIST information number, which gives you the actual time.
Yeah, they want to warn you, this isn't the actual. I used to tune this in via shortwave.
At the tone, 16 hours, 34 minutes, coordinated universal time.
Oh, I'm sorry, but I must be a nerd because I love that. There's something about that I just love.
Yeah, I mean, there is a little bit of a pop culture, you know, surrounding, you know, the listening to of, you know, the time. And actually, those tones are actually standard frequencies.
Oh, are they? So a machine could listen to that and understand it as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you could actually calibrate like a, you know, a tuning fork.
Are there time nerds?
Oh yeah, there's definitely time nerds. There's actually a website and kind of a message board dedicated to it called Time Nuts.
Time Nuts.
I love it. I'm kind of a time nut, I think.
Yeah, and these guys, I mean, a lot of these people are very serious. You know, they have atomic clocks in their house, not radio controlled clocks, but actually cesium clocks.
What? Wait a minute.
Can I know recently there was
you're on time nuts.
There it is.
Second.com.
So you're telling me that people are
people
allowed to have their own cesium clock?
Yeah, are people buying these somewhere or building them themselves?
Yeah, they're actually commercially available.
I want one!
Because, I mean, a lot of laboratories will use them. So somebody like, you know, NASA or JPL or, you know, any kind of technology company, probably in manufacturing, might need to have an accurate frequency. So we're not talking about the time of day. You know, atomic clock that you buy off the shelf, it's going to give you a very, very, very accurate frequency. Mm-hmm. And you can use that actually to calibrate local equipment in a laboratory or a manufacturing facility. So they're commercially available. You could probably get one for about $40,000.
Okay, never mind. I don't want one.
Okay, but how about this? You can buy a rubidium atomic clock for maybe $2,000.
Okay, I want that. So what is rubidium?
So now rubidium is just another element. It's if you look at the periodic table, it's you know, they're both on the left side of the periodic table, the alkali metals, and it's not as quite a high resonant frequency of cesium as cesium, and it's different. The way that you generate the state change of the atom mm-hmm. is different. It's more in the optical kind of range.
Well, it makes sense. You don't have to have cesium. If you knew exactly what something was in relation to cesium, that would work, right?
But having a different resonant frequency, wouldn't that, or a longer wavelength, wouldn't that make it, would it be a little bit less accurate in measurement than the cesium?
Yeah, well, When we say, it's hard to say, you know, when you say accuracy versus stability and things, those kinds of terminology kind of come into play. But
rubidium is accurate to 1 in 10 to the 12th seconds.
It can be.
That's
one of the more expensive ones. That's not your $2,000.
That's not my $2,000 rubidium.
Yeah.
I want a rubidium watch. Does anybody make a rubidium watch?
I haven't seen one.
You've made me unhappy with my watch. Now I know it's just radio controlled. I don't want it anymore. I want rubidium. I want to know it's accurate.
So say you had a rubidium oscillator or clock and a cesium oscillator clock, and you set them to be exactly the same.
Yeah.
The rubidium would get off in frequency over time faster than the cesium would.
Got it.
So
that's why they chose cesium?
Right. And if you're using it for time of day, either one of them is going to stay on the same second for...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The cesium is going to stay on the same second for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years.
Right.
So, right.
Is there anything better than cesium? Was there a compromise? Did they have to compromise for cesium?
Well, they do use hydrogen. Mm-hmm. It's called a hydrogen maser. And it's actually very, very stable on the short term.
Right.
Whereas cesium is a little bit more stable on the long term. So it kind of depends on what your use is. But the maser is going to cost, commercial maser, right. It might cost you like a couple hundred thousand.
That was a predecessor to the laser, yeah.
Right. Now, I was thinking
It's in conjunction with,
They still make
it's like a laser, but it's a different frequency.
Right.
Right.
So laser, what does laser stand for? Here's your quiz.
Light.
I did this just the other day, so I should know it. Something emitted radiation, coherent, I don't know.
It's light amplification.
Amplification.
Stimulated emission of radiation.
Stimulated emission radiation. And maser is?
Through microwave.
Microwave, right.
So a laser is actually in the optical frequency range, and a maser is in the microwave frequency range. So gigahertz.
Mm-hmm.
I just looked, and there's no rubidium clocks on Amazon.com, unfortunately.
Sorry, Leo.
here's kind of an interesting thing. So how we actually have the time of day, we have our NIST F1 cesium fountain clock, and that's our primary standard.
Can you bring up a picture of the fountain?
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to have just one clock or oscillator be your standard, right? Because say something happened to it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have several commercial atomic clocks, cesium and hydrogen masers, and they're all averaged together. It's called an ensemble. Mm-hmm. So we actually average those all together in a weighted average. There's the fountain clock.
What is a fountain? Is it a cascade somehow of cesium? What is? I don't understand.
What they do is basically, or what we do, I should say, what anyone does who has a fountain.
This happens to be your particular fountain.
Yeah, because I don't work on the fountain. But what we do is we actually make a ball. We trap a ball of cesium atoms with in a laser, in a field of lasers, and we do laser cooling. So, which was one of the things that was a Nobel Prize in physics several years ago, laser cooling. And we actually cool down these atoms so that we can actually hold them, in a field. Yeah, so if you see, like, in that blue ball in the center of all the lasers.
Mm-hmm. That's a cesium ball.
Right, so it's a ball of hundreds and thousands of cesium atoms.
Held and in then, kind of suspension by these lasers.
By the lasers.
Right, and that was a big kind of groundbreaking thing that was developed as a way to kind of suspend atoms in air.
Anti-gravity and, lasers.
Yeah. So what it does then, it actually gives the atoms a little bit of a momentum in the upward direction, and so it kind of tosses them straight up in the air, and they go through that kind of cylindrical donut shape thing, and then they fall back down back through that same field. And then they're hit by a laser. And so what we do is in that donut, I'll call it, because it sounds delicious.
You mean the microwave cavity?
Yeah, the microwave cavity. We actually hit the atoms with a microwave frequency that we believe to be the exact frequency that will make the atoms change state. That's that 9.192631770 gigahertz frequency.
Wow.
And so that, by definition, if we produce that frequency that makes a cesium atom change, that's the frequency that we have. And so what we do is we lock on our frequency to, you know, the microwave cavity to produce a frequency that makes the most atoms change state. Mm. And if we're locked on to the most atom transitions, then by definition, that's the frequency that we have.
That's interesting. And again, so again, you're averaging, really. I mean, you're still not.
Yeah, it really is an average.
It's still averaging, but you are defining by the
yeah, that's the definition.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
Yeah, you're defining what that frequency is going to be in effect.
Right. Yeah. And so we say, okay, well, if we've maximized our, you know, our peak of the transitions of atoms, that's the frequency we have. And you can divide that down, you know, to any frequency to, you know, 5 megahertz or, mm-hmm. you know, 1 hertz if you want to have an actual clock that ticks at 1 second.
Once per second. But that doesn't work for the atomic clock. I mean, the frequency that you've chosen. I mean, is that the average frequency? The 9.19. It's close to 1 second, but not exactly.
Right? Well, no, that is 1 second by definition.
By definition, a second is that not is. Really. Okay, I get it.
So basically, right. in 1967, when the second was defined with its current definition, they said the second is based on the hyperfine transition of cesium-133 mm-hmm. at 9192631770.
That's just the definition, yeah.
Hertz.
Yeah.
So if I can produce a transition that makes the cesium atom change, kind of by definition, because it was, you know, human-made definition, then I have that frequency.
Yep.
So it's kind of circular in a way.
It's interesting.
We say it is because it's like the caterpillar on the mushroom. A word is what I say it is. The time is what we say it is.
What got you interested in working on time and the atomic clock? Yeah. How did you get to doing your job?
Yeah, it's kind of more proximity based, I would say. You know, I went to school at the University of Colorado uh-huh. in Boulder. And just through, you know, having a work study grant, and I was looking for a work study job in electrical engineering. And so I found, you know, this job opportunity at NIST. And so I worked there all through college and, you know, just stayed there. And I'm still there. So just kind of learned about it, you know, on the job.
And your degree is in engineering, mechanical engineering?
Yeah, electrical engineering.
Electrical engineering, okay.
Yeah. And it's mostly physicists, like the people who mm-hmm. actually, you know, design and build the atomic clocks are mostly physicists, PhD physicists.
Yeah. Now the fountain clock that you have at NIST, that's the big one, but there are these smaller clocks that physicists have recently designed the rice grain sized
you mean
atomic
this one?
Clock.
You mean
wait, get it? It switched
you mean
on
that
you.
One?
That's the Nixie tube.
That's a Nixie tube. That's like Woz has. That's a Nixie tube watch. But that's not atomic, but in any sense.
No.
No. In fact,
what Kirsten's is talking about is this chip scale clock. I think
really?
A picture of that too.
Oh, that's an interesting. Why not have it chip scale?
There
huh?
is an image of
there
it up
is.
Here.
Yeah. So what chip that scale. Is like, you know, about a cubic centimeter. They have made cesium and rubidium chip scale clocks. So they can actually put this. You know, somewhat, I mean, that's kind of a prototype, but imagine chip scale, you could put it on a microchip, which means you really could have an atomic watch.
So, but
right,
GPSs don't have that accurate of a, the satellite, what's in the satellites?
So the satellite actually has commercial cesiums.
It does.
And they're space grade. They're probably a little bit better than the cesiums you'll buy for 40K because mm-hmm. they're designed specifically to go in space.
Interesting. So they have a cesium clock. And yeah, of course you don't need a clock in your GPS device because it gets that from by triangulating the GPS devices.
Right.
It actually does have an oscillator in it.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, say you went inside, your GPS still has a clock, right?
Right. It can maintain the time, but it's not getting the time. It's not generating it itself.
Right. It just maintains it.
Yeah. Not just my stupid radio-controlled watch that I no longer love.
Don't be down on your watch, man.
I'm bummed, man. So how long before I have this chip-based clock in my watch? That's what I want.
I don't know. You know, it's kind of been turned over now to industry. One of the goals of NIST is really to expound on technology and do research and development and then hand that over to industry to let them design you know, commercial product.
Does this use the same fountain design? I mean, is it the same idea?
No, this is a closed cell. So like in the fountain clock, once the ball of atoms is tossed up and then comes back down, those atoms are no longer used.
Oh, so you have to refresh it. Oh,
yeah, you have to refresh it. Yeah. And that's why rubidium clocks are so much more, you know, reasonably priced, and they can be smaller, is because there's a bulb of rubidium in there that's actually changed back and forth between two different states continually. Right. And same with the chip scale clock. It's actually a closed system where you're actually changing the atomic state of those atoms back and forth. So you don't lose it. You can actually, you know, there's different frequencies to change it from a higher energy state to a lower energy state, from the lower energy state to the higher energy state.
So how many in your facility at NIST, how many of these giant fountains? Is there just one? Is there a number of them?
There's just one fountain clock, and we're actually building NIST F2. So you could say there's two now.
There's going to be two.
F2 isn't online yet.
Right. And then there's other clocks in other places so that you compare and...
Around the world.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why a second? What's the F2 going to do for NIST?
So the F2 should be... NIST F1 is like, you know, parts in 10 to the 15th, or possibly parts in 10 to the 16th. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is... you can realize frequency with, you know, 15 decimal places of resolution. So,
let's see if I can get this one right. A picosecond? Is that right?
Pico is 10 to the 12th.
Darn it! Femto?
Femto or peta.
Femto second. There we go.
Holy camoly.
Yeah. And don't even talk about atto seconds. That's, you know.
Is that right. Next? Atto seconds?
To the 18th?
Yeah. So... So NIST F2 should, you know, just be more stable and, you know, be able to resolve the second to that much, you know, hopefully orders of magnitude better than NIST F1.
Wow. Right.
And that probably is, it will be the theoretical limit of cesium.
Wow.
So the next thing after NIST F2 will probably not be cesium. They will change the definition to something like, you know, mercury, or, you know, there's calcium being looked at now. There's all sorts of different ion clocks.
What's driving this run to accuracy? I mean, who needs this?
Well, that's what I was kind of saying earlier. It's not that it's necessary right now, but that's we're not driven by necessity. We're just driven by technology.
Theoretical limits. Just what can I do?
Beating our own, you know.
It's like a runner. A runner who wants to beat their own record.
So there's nobody saying, my God, you need femtosecond accuracy. Come on, Andrew, I'm waiting.
And if you had it, I mean, that's the other thing. We have to build measurement systems to be able to make those comparisons.
Right. Well, I'm just wondering, now we have, like, down here at Stanford in Palo Alto, we have a molecular... They're basically building a cellular level microscope so that you can image processes, molecular processes taking place within cells as they happen. So these processes actually occur at the nanosecond scale, at the femtosecond scale. So I guess in terms of scientific research, and as we start looking at these smaller and smaller and smaller pieces of the universe, this ever more accurate time telling is probably going to really come into play.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. That's what I think.
Wow. I love it. I mean, who cares? Do it for the science of it. It doesn't matter if nobody wants it. Just do it.
Just do it.
Just do it, man. The Nike philosophy applies to seconds as well as to running.
Yeah. Do you have any ideas as to, I mean, aside from better wristwatches or for the time nuts out there, what applications? There's GPS that we've got so far. There's
nanotech.
Potentially.
What are the
applications that this is going to drive?
Yeah, it's a lot of communications in space. You know, when we have like the Mars lander and Mercury, you know, different kinds of long range things like in space.
Yeah.
Need very accurate frequencies for radio transmissions and radio signals. But then even something like cell phones, I mean, we're way beyond the, what cell phones need, but it's a good example of, you know, the more accurate and stable the frequency in a cell phone tower means more bandwidth and more information, more data they can fit onto their into their transmission. So if they had better clocks in the cell phone base stations, you know, you would have faster internet onto your devices, or less dropped calls, things like that. Huh. So
that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, and so right now, probably in cell phone base stations, most likely there's rubidium oscillators.
Are you kidding? Yes. Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're using atomic technology. It's just, it would be more expensive to put cesium in, and the necessity is not quite there. But I think it's coming up pretty fast. They're going to need, you know, better oscillators in the cell phone base station.
That must make a cell phone base station pretty expensive. I had no idea they were putting rubidium clocks in there.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, what's the percentage of people who, I guess, use NIST and other atomic clock locations as their base for standardizing time, as opposed to buying their own? Like, do you know what kind of level of propagation these other rubidium clocks and other companies and industrial applications of the cesium clock happen to be compared? I mean, there's the NIST standard and the universal standard, but then all these other places.
Is there Joe's standard? I mean, does somebody else have a standard?
I mean, I would say probably no, in the sense of any national laboratory is referenced to, you know, the BIPM and Coordinated Universal Time. So that way everybody is, you know, kind of on the same page, and everyone agrees that what the BIPM says as far as what our national average is the correct answer. And they publish, you know, how far off all of the contributors are to that. Mm-hmm. So you could imagine a scenario where you made your own measurements and you couldn't really submit to the BIPM because you'd have to be a national laboratory. But right. You could, you know, broadcast it throughout your neighborhood if you want.
Leo's
local time.
Yeah. The time is now 3:43.
People would get so confused.
Leo's clock.
Yeah, so I would say probably the level of accuracy is really very linear with the number of users. In other words, people who need to know it to the second, you know, is in the millions, whereas people who need to know, say, a nanosecond,
right,
a lot less.
I need to know the second, yeah, though. I mean, that's not an unusual or unreasonable need. I mean, if I'm in radio, I need to be synchronized within the second. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And if you think about, like, time codes and video and television.
Time
and
codes. That's that, right.
Those need to be. I mean, those are sub-second for
absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. They're milliseconds. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. This is now. Let's talk about leap seconds, because here we are. We are doing this show on New Year's Eve. Is it a Andrew, is this a busy time for you?
Well, this year we happen to not be having a leap second.
You don't have to, like, go in on New Year's Eve and monitor the clock or anything.
No, I mean, everything is
kind it's of all automatic. Yeah.
Although when there is a leap second, we're usually there just to make sure that everything happens correctly. Because what happens is, so at midnight UTC, which you know, would be 5 p.m. here or 4 p.m. there in California, there's actually an extra second. So at, you know, 11:59 p.m. Coordinated Universal Time, it would go like 58 seconds, 59 seconds, and then 60 seconds, and then 0 seconds. So it's kind of like you actually you add an extra second in there, much like a leap day. There's an extra day. There's an extra second, and that kind of lets the Earth catch up to what time we say it is. So that way we're synchronizing, you know, with the Earth's rotation.
I love, there's a science fiction novel I'm reading right now, Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars, and Mars is slightly different time from ours. So they have a 40-minute, every day they have a 40-minute slip, time slip they call it, where the clocks just stop. And I just love the idea of
because
this.
They keep it on a 24-hour day, but it's the day itself on Mars is longer.
It's 40 minutes longer, so they have to do this time slip.
That's exactly the same kind of thing. It's, right. It's stopping one to keep coordinated with the other one.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe we'll, and it will, it has only ever happened at the end of December or the end of June, just kind of as a convention.
Why would you do it in June?
Well, it just depends on how far the Earth has gotten off.
Oh.
I mean, if the Earth is really, I mean, it's cyclical, so.
But is it predictable or is it unpredictable?
It's fairly unpredictable. I mean, it has to do with, you know, tides.
So you would declare a second. You would declare a leap second at random intervals.
Yeah, there's actually a bureau called the IERS, International Earth Rotation Service. And they do long-ranging laser, you know, experiments in space to see where exactly the Earth is in its rotation. And so they're the ones who kind of tell us, like, hey, the Earth is, you know, another tenth of a second off from the time.
Because that's really getting back to the question I asked originally, which is there an absolute time?
Yeah.
And there isn't, I mean,
there really is, but...
But nobody wants to observe it.
It's human defined. So it's...
Right.
We just all agree that what we say is that time is that time.
And we want to keep it kind of in sync with nature. We don't want to make it get out of sync with nature.
Right. For instance, since 1967, there's actually been 34... It's an equivalent of, I think, 34 leap seconds.
Wow, and quite a bit.
That's how far off the Earth has gotten from the definition of the second.
And will this change? So, you know, as our orbit changes, is there going to be at some point where it's not just a leap second, but maybe a leap 2 seconds? Or, you know, is this something that will have to be adjusted over the next millennia?
Well, the current definition for leap seconds is, you know, we always want to keep the time... of day relative to the Earth within, you know, within 0.9 seconds. So it's always within the same second.
Okay.
So what usually happens is they let it drift so that the Earth is about 0.5 seconds behind, 0.5 seconds behind, I should say. And then when there's a leap second, that makes it 0.5 seconds ahead. And we watch it precess back through the zero. And so...
And then start the clock again.
Yeah. So... But it's always 1 second. So we usually wait till it's about a half second off, and then it goes a half second the other side. So if the Earth was, you know, slowing down even more, then we could have 2 leap seconds, one in June and one in December.
Or you
could have them at other months also, but we've never had to have that many. There's only, I think, been 1 year where there was actually 2 leap seconds, but they weren't at the same time. They were spread apart.
And the leap second is, it, like you said, it's been since the 50s, so this is a new construct. This is something that, with the advent of the atomic clock and increased accuracy of measuring the Earth's position in space and increased accuracy in measuring time, it's become a necessity. But before then, it wasn't something that was even thought about.
Right. They used to adjust the clocks to match the Earth, but then with, you know, in the 60s with atomic clocks, now we found
that it's very difficult to match the Earth to the clocks, so we're just going to keep matching the clocks to the Earth. I think that the Earth is just not cooperating in this respect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I just think this is the greatest thing ever. I don't know why. I must be a time nerd.
I think you are.
I don't know why. Does it not? Is it not unusual? Do you become a time nerd if you work at NIST, Andrew?
Oh yeah, I think you do. You know, it's around us all the time. So you know.
And what wristwatch do you wear?
Look, I'm not even wearing a watch.
Ah! Nobody wears watches anymore. Watches are retro.
He's been irradiated enough. You know?
Wear a watch?
He's internalized the cesium fountain.
Well, I had a radio-controlled watch, and the battery went out, and I haven't got a new battery for it, and it's been about 2 years. So I guess I don't really need it.
Everybody has
so many clocks at work.
Right. And it's in your cell phone now. I think that's why nobody wears watches anymore.
That's true. It's really the cell phone has really kind of institutionalized people knowing what time it is.
And are cell phone clocks pretty accurate if they're syncing to the network?
If they're syncing to the network, they are, because, you know, those base stations have a GPS.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they may be actually more accurate than your atomic so-called clock or wristwatch, your radio wristwatch.
It might be. It just
syncs more often.
How often it's syncing. But, you know, the problem with some cell phones, they only synchronize, some of them only synchronize if you turn it off and back on.
Oh.
And nowadays, no one ever turns off their cell phone.
Right.
They just plug it in and keep charging it. So some people's cell phone, you know, they'll write us and say, you know, Well, compared to time.gov, my cell phone is off by 2 minutes. And it means clearly that their cell phone is not synchronizing.
Right. You need to let your battery run out so that you can synchronize properly. What are you looking forward to working on this next year in 2010? It's the new year. Is there anything new on the horizon for comparative algorithms for time?
Well, I'm working on the new version of time.gov, which is not really comparisons, but it will be, you know, an upgrade to the current time.gov.
Do you maintain that yourself? Is that your thing?
Yeah, that's one of the things I work on.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. So I'm working on that. And then we're working on a project where we're actually doing live comparisons of atomic clocks all throughout North and South America. Huh. Because this whole procedure of sending data to the BIPM, there's a huge lag in when they publish the information. So everyone has to send in their data, and the BIPM waits till everyone's data's in, and then they kind of do the number crunching, and they say, here's how far off everyone was from each other at that time. So it could be several weeks later. They say,
wow,
this is what time it was, you know, 3 weeks ago.
It's like, that was 3 weeks ago. We've moved on.
Yeah. So what we're doing is using the internet and this Common View GPS thing, we're actually helping sync up a bunch of countries all through North and South America, you know, Canada, Mexico, Costa Rica, Colombia, Brazil. And so we have identical systems at all of these countries making comparisons and sending us the data over the web. And so every 10 minutes, we're actually publishing, you know, to the nanosecond, how far off all these countries are from each other. So it's actually a much, you know, it's a revolutionary way of, you know, doing these comparisons in a lot faster, more useful way.
Well, according to time.gov, it's 16:08 and 53:54 seconds. So I think we better wrap this up. I love this.
We ran out of time.
Time is, you can never win with time. It always keeps going all the time.
Yeah, well, I'm sure with your work on time.gov and the UTC, you probably are much better at figuring out what time it is in London versus Africa versus...
I'm bad at that. I'm always trying to figure that out.
I have to set up interviews with people all over the world. And for me, sometimes to figure out what time it is and whether or not it's daylight savings time or not.
Well, that's a good question. Andrew, what's your thought on daylight savings time?
I mean, get rid of it?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I hate to keep correcting you, but it's kind of fun. It's actually daylight saving time. There's no
saving.
S.
Yes.
Daylight saving time. Well, there you go. I've been saying it wrong for 53 years.
Yeah. And I don't know how much it doesn't save a lot of energy. In other words, like your energy bill is not going to be significantly less.
But overall, but it saves a considerable amount.
I think it has shown that it saves like a little bit of energy for each person, thereby which like a country and a country infrastructure, it might have saved some energy.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not really a morning person, so I like to be, you know, out in the afternoon and
I would rather
see it daylight saving time all the time.
Yeah.
Because
stay light a little later.
It's dark in the morning. I'd rather have it stay light later. So but then that's not really up to us either. That's
political. That's government. I understand. It's not.
Yeah. The Department of Transportation kind of oversees daylight saving time.
Right.
And it's actually legislated on a county level.
Really?
In other words, if you could get your county seat to agree or vote or something that your county didn't want to follow daylight saving time, you could.
And it would just be your county. So say
that's going to screw everything
Sonoma
up.
County in California.
Yeah. It's just going to mess everything up.
So Indiana was a classic example where there was, the time zone lines and the lines of counties that followed daylight saving time or not was very messy. And just a couple years ago, they actually legislated it on a statewide level that said, okay, you counties, you know, decide what time zone you're going to be in. And everyone's going to follow daylight saving time because this is ludicrous. You know, there was little pockets of Indiana that didn't follow it.
I remember that. Yeah.
So, but something like Hawaii doesn't follow daylight saving time.
Right.
And most of Arizona does not follow daylight saving time. I believe Puerto Rico does not. If you're closer to the equator, where the length of daylight is about the same, you know, each day. It doesn't really, it's actually throws it off, a lot farther than the natural amount of daylight would happen. So you could see where near the equator they wouldn't want to follow this.
Yeah. Makes sense. This is all so interesting.
Yeah. Really nice to meet you, Andrew. And now you've turned me into a time nerd.
You were before. This was just a reinforcement.
I think I am. I got a radio control clock behind me on my wrist. That's all I ever wear. I love that idea that it's more accurate. Well, Happy New Year to you. I'm glad to know that you don't have to go in tonight to press the leap second button. How do you do that? Is there a button?
Well, there is a button, but it's really just for our display clock in the hallway.
That, shows that there's, so you don't like pause the cesium clock or something?
No, everything is really done automatically.
Its computer says, okay, I'm going to add this. And that's
it. Same with time.gov. You know, it.
Yeah.
When we tell it, hey, there's a leap second coming up.
That's too bad. Computers have taken all the fun out of leap seconds. Well, wouldn't it be cool to be the guy who has, his finger, okay, you hold it for 1 second, no more. I guess that wouldn't work.
No. I don't think a person is as accurate as a computer could be.
You go 1001.
Something, yeah.
And that's it? No?
Yeah.
1001, 1002. Okay, I'm done. One Mississippi.
You can do that yourself with Leo's clock.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Great to talk to
thanks.
You.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity.
It's what fun. Fascinating subject. Isn't that funny?
This was really, really great.
Yeah, really interesting. Yeah,
we really appreciate it, and we appreciate the efforts of NIST
to get
you on the show. And
NIST is a government agency everybody loves, right?
I hope so. I mean, I think so.
It's beloved.
Yeah, because standards really, they're standards for all sorts of things.
We need it.
And that's what kind of keeps things together.
And it's kind of non-controversial. Yeah.
And it's, if you think about, we're comparing clocks with all countries around the world. And time is actually one of the things, if only, or standards, it's the only things that we really
can all agree on. Yep.
So it's fun to be in that.
I love it. Thank you, Andrew Norvik. Great to talk to you.
And I think that's a wonderful, wonderful note to end the show on to start the new year on.
We can all agree on one thing.
Time.
Time. And that's we've just run out of it.
And we've run out.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Andrew. Take care. Bye-bye. What a great subject. I love
that. That's great.
The champagne might have helped me like it a little more than I would have normally. But I think that's wonderful. And if you think about it, we're all time nerds now because all of our devices are syncing up. But nobody.
My cell phone is syncing up.
When's the last time somebody said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I missed the meeting. My alarm was off, or my clock was slow." You can't say that anymore. You don't get away with that anymore.
It was just your fault for hitting the snooze button.
Yeah. You don't get to say my wristwatch is 10 minutes slow. You can't say.
No,
that.
I love the idea that he brought up though that. That the cesium clock is reaching the peak of its accuracy, and that they're going to be moving on to different atomic substances, to different elements, to be able to create the new clock, the next level in accuracy, to be able to get it ever smaller chunks of time.
So we're at nanos now, but we're going to femtos, or is it picos next? Nanos then picos.
Nano, pico, femto, atto.
Atto.
Yeah.
If you get to atto seconds, you're living in the future.
Yeah.
It won't be in my lifetime.
So if you want more information on the atomic clock and time, you can go to tf.nist.gov. Or if you just want to check the time, you can go to time.gov and you can look at what time it is in different parts of the country. And you can thank Andrew for taking care of that wonderful application.
Great?
Yeah, the web app for that. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this has been Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, and next week we are taking a break. We are going to CES.
Kiki and I are going to be very busy.
Yeah, it's not going to be a break, really.
No.
It's a break from our Thursday schedule.
Right.
But we are going to be crazy busy, having a lot of fun running around at CES, finding out all sorts of...
Can't wait.
Consumer electronics.
It's going to be so much
secrets.
Fun. Yeah, yes. It's going to be so much fun. And I'm so thrilled that you're co-hosting. That's really great. Yeah, that's really great.
It's going to be super fun. So I'm really going to try to keep an eye out for the science-y tech news, the science angle on the electronics that are coming out, like finding, cool robotics things, the next best thing in goggles.
This is important to you.
It's very important to me. I really want a good pair of sciencey, techie goggles. That's what I'm. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah, and so in two weeks we'll be back, and we're all taking drugs.
All right.
Yeah.
I don't know what drug it is, but I'll take it. You already got me with the champagne.
That's right. This week it's champagne for New Year's.
What are we talking? What are we talking here? Genetic drugs?
No. Psychoactive drugs. We're going. I'm bringing in a neuropsychopharmacologist. Actually, a neuropsycho. Oh.
They're going to talk about how this stuff works.
Yeah.
The biology of psychoactive drugs. Wow.
Yes.
Oh, that sounds great.
A friend of mine who does research looking into how psychoactive drugs affect people and why they affect you in particular ways. So that's going to be a
really interesting. This is your neck of the woods too. This neuroscience stuff. So
And I did a. I worked for a year and a half in a neuropsychopharmacology lab doing human studies of psychoactive drugs.
Oh, interesting. And we're not just talking LSD. I mean, it would be...
cocaine, heroin, ecstasy.
And even prescription?
Marijuana.
Stuff?
Not so much prescription.
The illegal narcotics.
Illegal narcotics.
Psychoactives. Huh.
And these studies were funded by NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse.
Interesting.
So it's research to figure out...
the mechanism.
Yeah, find out how things affect people. So in what ways they affect people, whether it... and then how we can take advantage of understanding the mechanism to create methods to stop abuse.
That's great.
Yeah.
Good.
So Matthew Baggett, he does some really great research, and so he's an interesting guy. He's going to be fun to talk to. We're going to do that in 2 weeks. And you can find me online. Talk to me on Twitter at Dr. Kiki, D-R-K-I-K-I. And tweet me later. Peace out, dudes.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll. But listen closely.
Not for very much longer.
I've got to keep control.